Paul Sum was one of the children who managed to escape Cambodia's killing fields. He survived 3 years in one of the child labor camps, and he saw more death there than he cares to remember. He escaped to Thailand and eventually made it to the U.S. as a refugee. He lost track of his family for 20 years. In all that time, whenever he needed to clear his mind, he'd concentrate on honing his skills as a kickboxer. He says it gave him a way to block out the bad memories.
I just want to block all my, forget about my past. I don't think about something out behind me no more. Block everything, make you happy, you know, make you say, well, I feel good, you know.
Paul Sum takes us back to the killing fields and the labor camps, and to the story of his escape and his eventual reunion with his family. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The memories of what Cambodians suffered under the Khmer Rouge came sharply back into focus this past weekend with the death of the photojournalist Dith Pran. He's the man whose story is at the heart of the book and the film, The Killing Fields. After Dith Pran moved to the U.S., he never stopped working to make sure that people knew what had happened to his people. And he said it again in the last interview he gave to the New York Times from his hospital bed.
Please, everybody, must stop the killing field. Not allow this to exist again. One is enough. Too many. One time is too many. If they can do that for me, my spirit will be happy.
Dith Pran spoke most forcefully about what he'd seen happen to the children of Cambodia.
I promised myself, if I survive this killing field, I would not stop talking about this kind of crisis. So I figured out to remind the people that not only adults suffer, it's the children of Cambodia killing field suffer tremendously too.
My guest today was one of those children. Paul Sum was the son of a rice farming family. He was 13 years old when Khmer Rouge soldiers came to his village and demanded that all the people gather in the square.
The whole group, they dressed the same color, black and white. Then they tell the people, we have a meeting. You know, the whole town come out like, we have a meeting. We say, right now it's no more army in here. We're taking over now. You have to listen to what we tell you. You have to eat the same food we tell you.
Was it frightening?
Oh, yeah. People come up here, boom, and tell you what to do. You don't expect. Only thing you do, you just listen to them, you know. If you don't listen, they tell you. You just disappear. You never come back.
What happened to your family?
When I was over there, they took me away from my mom. My mom was go to work with the rice field.
Your mother was in the rice fields
working
for the Khmer Rouge?
Then Khmer come and take me away from my mom. My mom didn't know. Then they moved me out away from the house.
So on the day that you were taken, your mother was in the rice field?
Yes, working.
Where were you?
I was at home.
And so when the Khmer Rouge came to take you, you didn't have a chance to say goodbye
to
your mother?
No, I didn't say nothing. They just take me to the camp.
What happened with your sister and
your
father?
They let me stay in there.
Your sister stayed
at
the house?
They stay in the home, but me, I'm only boy, they take me away.
And your father, what about him?
My father, he's still there.
They didn't take your father?
He don't take my father, but they questioned my father then.
Paul's father knew better than to say anything to the Khmer Rouge interrogators. He and his brother, Paul's uncle, had been helping the American army. But Paul's uncle was tricked into revealing his own involvement.
The trick on him, they say, well, we're going to put you in a good place. They say, we can feed you good, we can take care of you good. Then they say, yeah, come on to the front. Then my uncle, he thought, well, he's the top one, he come to the front, he just disappeared. Not only kill him, they kill the whole family. Only one left survived.
So you were taken away. You didn't have a chance to say goodbye to your mother. Did you say goodbye to your father?
No, nobody at all. I'm just like, I'm going to play, you know.
You didn't know where you
were
going?
I didn't know where I'm going anyway. They take me. They just put me in there. When they start out, they would not get you far from the house. They get move you a little bit farther and farther. You can't know at all.
So at the beginning, how far from the house were you?
Maybe, I say around about 10 miles, maybe 20 miles, maybe away from the house.
But you could never go back.
You never go back. You don't have a car. You have to walk.
If you could walk, would they let you walk?
No. You got to have permission. They say no, you don't go. They ask you, you say, I want to see my mother. They say, well, we don't want you to go. Sometimes they let me go when I got sick real bad. You know, they can't treat me because my grandfather, he's a medicine man.
So you could go home
when you got sick? I can go home and I get treated.
Did you see your mother, father, and
Yeah,
grandfather?
I see my mother, my grandmother, and my grandfather then.
But that must have been difficult for you because you knew that when you got better, you'd go back to the
camp. Yeah, go back to the same place. I cry every day, you know. When they take away from me, I cry days and night. You know, when I get up in the morning looking there, I can see it, my hometown, the mountain. That's what make me sad about. Like you're looking that way, you see right there, but you can't go, you know.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Paul Somme told me that at first, when the Khmer Rouge told him they were taking him away to a camp, he misunderstood. He thought they were going camping. It didn't take him long to figure out the rules of life in a child labor camp.
They put you to work. That's all they want you to do. They don't study, no nothing. They put you to work. In the daytime, they make me to cut some kind of leaf, chop it up.
You're making fertilizer.
Yeah, fertilizer to make to the rice.
And that's all you did?
That's all we
all
did.
All day, just chop,
all
chop,
chopping,
chop.
Yeah, from day, the morning until the sundown, sun up, sundown. That's all. Then they let you eat. They don't have nothing to eat. They, whatever the food, little bit they got in there, they put maybe a lot of vegetable in there. It might be a cup, a little bit of rice, and they boil a lot of water and put the food in and let you eat it. Just enough to be surviving.
So like rice soup with some
vegetables.
That's
vegetable
it,
yeah, in but it's
right?
Not, it's not the rice soup you got now. It's just whatever they put in there, you eat in there. And you don't say nothing out.
Did they beat you in the camp?
They never had beat me, but they locked me up at nighttime.
Yeah, tell me about that. Where did you guys sleep?
We sleep there on the floor, the weight ring, whatever.
You and all the other boys?
All the boys. Then they got the whole roof thing, but it's no closing. When the ring, you get wet and everything. They
right.
lock.
There's a roof
there,
over your head, but no walls,
there, no,
right?
Yeah, you lay there, and the nighttime, they just run the whole rod, go everybody in the lake at the same time. Like,
so everybody had to lie down in a row, and
yeah.
This same iron bar
yeah, then
went
hit
through
one
your
time,
leg
yeah.
shackles,
then
they right?
locked it up, yeah. Just like a wood.
So you couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom
no,
in the middle
can't.
Of the night.
No, you had to pee and whatever.
What happens if somebody got sick or really sick and they were locked up?
They don't
up?
Care. They die. That's why they want you to die.
Are you saying that you would be in these leg irons and kids on one side of you or the other would die at
if
night?
They die there beside you. You just nothing they can do because that's what they want to kill you anyway, slowly.
Did that happen to you? Do you
yes,
remember that?
I remember people died there and sleep there beside me because they're sick. They can't go nowhere, and I can't help them. They can't help me.
Did you have friends in this camp?
Yeah. Everyone was friends. We worked together.
So these kids who were getting sick and dying, you knew
That's
them.
Right.
They weren't just strangers, right?
Uh-huh.
You were such a young boy at the time. What was that like for you, those mornings, when you'd wake up and find someone beside you wasn't alive?
And I think I'm going to be the next one. I'm going to be the next person dead sooner or later. See, at nighttime, they question you one in a person in a time. The Khmer Rouge, they call a question like, what you do? What your daddy do? They try to trick out a kid, then they can kill a kid. You know, they make sure the kid will tell, you know, because they want to be like, have food to eat, that rye, you know, real rye to eat, you know. They trick you and say, you tell me the truth. Your daddy was working this, working there. I will take you away from here and feed you good and just feed it like we do. We give you a real rye and everything. Then some of them kids are hungry. They just trick them. They say, yeah, my daddy's in, you know, my army. They do the same thing to me. But I'm not say anything. I just say, I don't know, you know. That kid say that night, you never see them kid coming back. Sometime at nighttime, when they take a person to there to kill, you can hear the screaming. They don't shoot you. They just hit you with a piece of bamboo or something, just knock you out. You're not dead or not. They just bury you in there. It don't matter, dog or children. They make you dig your own hole first.
Then they hit you in the head with
the
bamboo.
They hit you in the head right there. Just tie you back behind your back like this. Turn around and knock you in the head. You're dead or not. They just bury you in there. Sometimes you see people scream, you know, in nighttime, you know, and you know they did because they're not coming back.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Paul Somme and the other boys knew the actual killing fields were nearby. It wasn't until the Khmer Rouge soldiers ordered them to start digging up potatoes that he faced the horror himself. It's a memory that 30 years later he still tries to block.
We already know that field is going to be all the dead people in there anyway, but we can't say nothing. We already know that.
So you're working, digging potatoes in a field, and you know that there are
people
buried?
People already dead in there because we seed it, but you can't say nothing.
How deep into the soil are the people
it's
buried?
It's not deep. It's about 4 inches when you dig about that deep.
So you're digging 4 inches down in this field, and you're coming across?
Yeah, you see the clothes, you see the bone and everything. The whole clothes, you can tell it. People are about, you can't say nothing. Just keep going.
And what exactly were you doing? Digging up the potatoes?
They got potatoes to eat. That's all they're going to feed you. We got plenty of rye to grow all year long, but I don't know what the rye they're taking to.
You would spend all your time growing rice, but they would take all that away.
Yeah, take all the way. We never see the rice to feed the people in there.
The potatoes were for you.
Yeah, the potato and the potato leaf, you eat with it.
Did you feel funny about eating those potatoes?
Well, you're hungry, you eat anything because you have no choice to survive. If you're hungry, which one you want to do? You're going to be diet out eating or you're going to eat potato?
Did you think that you would ever get out of that camp?
No, I'm not. I have no hope.
3 years after Paul Soum had been locked away, he and the other boys got a break. The Khmer Rouge was losing its hold on power, and one of the guards whispered to the boys that he would leave the evening leg irons unlocked and that it would be up to them to decide what to do.
That Khmer Rouge army tell me and said, you do what you want to. We fight again in Vietnamese right now, and you're not able to fight, you're too young. That's what they tell me that. You can go back home, or you can stay here with us.
What did you do?
I just decided to go with the group, just walk. Because I can't go back home, I'm going to get killed anyway, because the fight's over there, you know.
Right.
I had to go a different way. And we didn't know where we go anywhere, we may start off with anywhere.
How long were you walking?
1 month.
You walked for a month across?
For a month to Thailand, from Cambodia to Thailand.
Through the mountains?
Through the mountain, through the water, through the jungle.
What was that like?
You walk all day long, then you stop whatever you have of water, then you take a rest.
And a number of other teenage boys?
Yeah, a bunch of group, yeah, teenagers, yeah.
So did you guys all make it to Thailand?
No, sir. No, sir, not all of it, except a few left. The rest of them dead over there. Sick, malaria.
How many people started out?
We probably have, I'd say around maybe from 2,000 or 1,500 people going, from the children and all the family and everything, but they never make through all that.
How many people made it to Thailand?
I'd say probably about 300 left over, because so many dies in there. We got some old folk cannot walk. She just sitting there ready to die.
I'll talk with Paul Soum about how he saved himself and made his way to America. That's in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In the late 70s, as many as 2 million people were killed in Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge. The fierce communist rulers told the people, "To keep you is no benefit, to destroy you is no loss." Much of what we in the West know of that time was told in the film The Killing Fields.
Cambodia. To many Westerners, it seemed a paradise. Another world, a secret world. But the war in neighboring Vietnam burst its borders, and the fighting soon spread to neutral Cambodia. It was there in the war-torn countryside amidst the fighting between government troops and the Khmer Rouge guerrillas that I met my guide and interpreter, Dith Pran, a man who was to change my life in a country that I grew to love and pity.
The respected Cambodian journalist, Dith Pran, the man whose own story was at the heart of the film The Killing Fields, died this past weekend. In his last interview, he asked that the stories of those who died in the killing fields and those who survived never be forgotten. My guest on today's program was one of those survivors. Paul Soum spent 3 years in a child labor camp before he made a break for the Thai border. Khmer Rouge soldiers were chasing them.
Khmer Rouge will chase you also. They shoot you down. They kill you. We got one man, you know, he got shot at, all his face gone. He sit there beside the creek, and he back for drink the water. And nobody help him at all. I just keep walking, just pop by. He just lay there. He point to the water. He can't talk. He said, "Get that."
And he's saying, "Give me water.
Give me some water. Die quicker. Drink water and die quick."
So why did nobody give him water?
I give him water. I dip the water, give it to him. But I just walk on too. That's all I remember to it. And it's just so much stuff to see, you know, when I growing up.
What was the most dangerous moment for you on that walk to Thailand?
I did not fear the army shooting me. I fear the animal like snake and stuff. Because you don't know what you're laying in. You lay in the ground.
Yeah, you don't have a bed or anything.
You don't know what I did. No, you're sleeping on the ground what you can. That's it. And you can't burn the fire too much because people know you there. You just burn nighttime. You just get it off. Cold, rain, See, when I left and from Thailand was a rain season too. Clear 1 minute, next minute movie, pour down the rain.
Did you think you would make it?
No. Just try to, you know, do what you can, you know. And up to that, we about almost crossed to the border of Thailand, and the river was pretty big river. The currents can suck you right in.
There's a big river there?
Yeah. Many people killed in there. It don't mind you a good swim, you did.
Did you get across this river?
I did.
How?
I don't know, because I just get one piece of wood and I jump on it. I did not swallow water. I did not drown. I just 5 miles from this end to this end, and I'm okay.
You got washed down the river
five miles, yeah, before I can come back at another end because water runs so fast.
Did you see other people drowning
yeah.
in this river?
People drown right there. They make a raft, their own raft, you know, homemade like bamboo, just torn over. A bunch of family go with the water, never come out.
When Paul Suom finally crossed the border into Thailand, he was put in a refugee camp with others from Cambodia. At first, he says, the refugee camp didn't seem much better than what he'd left behind.
When the first time arrived up there, we didn't have nothing, just slipping plastic or whatever we can find. They put a whole field, all the people in there.
Did they feed you?
No. They not feed you anything yet until in the morning. Then we have some UN come out there and pass us a rye, you know.
Good rice?
They don't give you a lot because a lot of people out there, you know, like a thousand, couple thousand people, they can't give you a lot, you know.
So your first meal in Thailand was a cup of rice?
Yeah, that's all.
When did you finally get some decent food?
I had to leave the camp to go to live to the monk. Then I got a decent ride.
Oh, you went with the Buddhist monks?
Yeah, Buddha monk in Thailand.
Do you remember that first meal, first good meal?
Yes. I have a rice and a vegetable with the meat, stir fry. You can't eat too much, you know, because your stomach was not used to eat a little bit.
You'll get
sick
if you eat
too
much.
You get sick, just eat what is for to stop, you know.
Paul, when did you start the dancing, dance lessons?
I started dancing in a camp.
In the camp, right?
Yeah, in a camp, yeah.
Now, was this Cambodian dancing or Thai dancing?
Cambodian dancing, traditional Cambodian dancing.
And was that the first time that you'd done that?
Yeah.
Why did you want to dance?
As all them old people over there in the camp tell me, say, this traditional dancing, we need to keep this alive. Then they say, you want to dance? I say, yeah. I go there and start practice dancing, you know. Then we've been dancing same.
But the old people said, look, we've got to keep this dance alive. Mm-hmm. You're still just a teenage boy. Why do you want to do it?
I want to feel like to be like traditional dancer.
It's hard to learn, though, isn't it?
It's hard to learn, yeah. You got to make your own handmade, too. You know, the coconut, the traditional dancing, you have to hit a coconut together and make the music thing. That's all I have been know how to do, play drum. I don't have no problem for that.
And what were you thinking about when you were dancing?
I think just keep the traditional alive, you know. Block all that Khmer Rouge thing teaching us to keep the old traditional coming back to me.
At this point, did you know where your family was?
No, I'm not.
You had no idea?
I had no idea for 20 years. I mean, I left in Cambodia. That's it. That's all I know. I thought they did. Dude, I don't think nobody survived. I don't think my mom survived. I don't think my sister survived. I think they all did.
So you just go ahead with your life all by yourself?
Yes.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Paul Suom ended up living with those monks near the refugee camp. To keep his mind occupied and away from his memories, he picked up the sport of kickboxing, and he found that he liked it.
I just want to block all my, forget about my past. I'm thinking about the person here with me. I don't think about something out behind me no more. Hmm.
Because when you're kickboxing, you need to concentrate.
Concentrate for the fighting, not concentrate about the past. I see the people did before. Oh, I see this. No, block everything. Make you happy, you know. Make you say, well, I feel good, you know.
Did it work? Did you forget about the past?
Yeah, I forget that. You know, I forgot that. And this is why the martial art kept me alive right now. Without a martial art, I would not be I am right now. Because a martial art will help me all through that.
So you're in one of these Thai boxing fights, and you're concentrating, you're thinking on the fight. You're not remembering
like all the stuff,
all the stuff from the past. But what about at night when you're lying in bed? Does it come back then?
No. Thinking about next day we're going to come back to train camp, make uh-huh. more better.
So the fighting is keeps you really
keep
focused,
wine,
right?
Yeah, keep me in a role like that. I don't think no more. I think about go to the ring, I excited, go there and fight. People cheer me, and I want to win a fight, you know, and that's it.
So did you get very good at it?
Yeah, I get good at it, and I fight in the National Thai Kickboxing.
You fought in the National Championships?
How
did you do?
I've not done very well, but some I lost, some I win.
Did they respect you as a fighter?
Yes, they respect me as a fighter. Kickboxing, very respectful. That's why I get my mind clear in there, you know.
So it looks like things are pretty good for you. You're a respected Thai boxing mm-hmm. fighter up to the national championship level. Why did you want to leave all that behind and move to the United States?
I have no way to turn back home.
Isn't Thailand your home now?
No, not my home. Because I'm living a refugee.
So you're not being accepted as a citizen
in
Thailand?
No, I'm not a citizen. They accept me as a Cambodian refugee. They're going to have to ship me back to Cambodia.
They were giving you a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to Cambodia
or
go to a new country, right?
Yeah.
But why not go back to Cambodia?
If I go back, if I don't have family, what you're going to do?
Let me ask you a question. Were you afraid to go back?
Yes, because that time was not settled yet. If I go back, if that thing still's going on, what happened to me? I might be dead. Still killing's going on, shooting's going on. Why would I walk back to that trail again? I'm going to find some place that would be peaceful for me.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. When Paul Swim is 21 years old, he actually gets the chance to move to the United States and live with a foster family. Now, by now, he's becoming more determined to get an education and to leave his past behind. So what was it like for him to move to this strange country halfway around the world without knowing any English?
Don't know what you expect. The food is different. You don't speak English. You don't know what to say. Because people here not like Cambodia or... I went to the school, a lot of kids don't talk to me. Some kid nice to me, some kid don't look at me.
Why would nobody look at you?
Because they think I was a different. Because I was an Asian, you know. They say, well, some people laugh at me, make fun of me, you know.
So you were made to feel like a foreigner.
Yeah. I don't feel like welcome here to an American, but I'm trying to make through it. Because I make through it before, I'm going to make through again. You know, I'm going to make my mind. It doesn't matter they like me or not. I come here to make my own self.
Still hard to do this when you don't have friends. You don't
that's
have
what
people
it's
to
hard
talk
to do.
To.
I got maybe one or two friends, but that's all I got in the school, you know. And people mean to me. People talk stuff to me, but I stand for myself then, you know.
Tell me more. What happened to you at school?
See, I go to school, you know, one guy, because he's called a bully. He was always hurt everybody.
Did he try to fight with you?
Oh, he did. And we went to the cafeteria eating. I sit at the table. Nobody wants to sit there. I sit alone myself. Then they got a bunch of friends sit over there. You know how the kid get along. And, you know, the milk, you know, the cart of milk.
Milk
not a
cartons,
short one. Yeah.
He
drink a half of milk there. Then he throw the milk there and stomp on me.
He drank half of the carton.
Then he bring the milk back, he stomped it.
He put it on the floor and then he stomped
stomach flies
on it.
All over me. That's the only thing make me angry then.
You had milk all over you at this time.
Yeah, all over my feet. Then I just stand up. I didn't say a word. I didn't speak English anyway. I go ahead and hit it between the eyes. It just fall backward. He a football player. I just knocked him one time. And that time people didn't know I know anything.
They didn't know you were a they national
know,
champion.
No, nothing. Nobody know nothing. I just say, I get tired of it. You know, I say, why are you stupid? People sit here alone by yourself. I said, you disrespect me, you know.
Did you get in trouble?
No, I don't. I go to the principal. I tell the principal what happened. They call my foster parent.
Called your foster parent.
Tell what's going on. I tell my foster parent, too, you know, what's going on before that happened. It was not only one time, a couple of times away, you know. And my foster parent, my daddy, he was a Marine. And he told me, I said, I tell you what, son. He done again. Go ahead and hit him. Then I did. I didn't want to do it, but I have to show respect, you know.
This bully, did he ever trouble you again?
No. After that, nobody bothered me. I have a lot more friends. Before, I didn't have no friend. After that, people say, oh, yeah, you cool, man. You know karate. I say, I don't know anything. I walk away from the problem all the time.
You're saying you don't look for a fight.
I don't look for a fight.
Was it a lonely time for you?
Yes. Sometimes I cry, you know. I miss back home, you know. I picture my family. Say, oh, this is my... Still picture my mom, my sister, and all that, you know. But... You miss, yeah.
Yeah, I just can't imagine what it's like. You have no one in your original family. You're not in your same country.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty hard for
it's
some.
It's hard, very, very hard. Plus, you don't speak English. But I proud of myself right now because I've done it so good for myself. At least I got American citizen. At least I know what I can go right now. I can go anywhere in the world. Nobody's going to stop me. I'm American right now.
Paul Swim married another Cambodian immigrant. He started a family and worked as a restaurant cook and a textile mill worker. But he kept wondering if anyone else in his family in Cambodia had survived the Khmer Rouge. A little over 10 years ago, a friend in the U.S. told him he was returning to Phnom Penh, and Paul took him to the airport, gave him some money, and asked for a favor.
Then I gave him $30. I said, look, you take that $30 right there, what I give to you, go to the radio station and broadcast it. I tell what my name, what I need to live in Cambodia, what my mom's name, my
you wanted this
name.
Guy to take this $30 and put an ad on the radio.
Radio. Then
with your name and your address.
I tell what my mother's name, what she live, and all that stuff. And the guy went to Cambodia. he went up to the radio station and gave the amount of people, and that's a lot of money, $30. You know, people glad to have that $30 to broadcast your.
So he did it.
He did it. And my mom here in the radio, and she not believe it. She went back to Phnom Penh.
Your mother was listening when the man
listened to the radio, and she wanted to meet this guy. And the guy staying in Phnom Penh, that's a capital in Cambodia. My mom traveled all over 3 hours from my hometown to Phnom Penh to meet this guy. And the guy know me. He said, yeah, you son of a lie. And he live close to me in the United States.
Did your mother believe this? Did your mother believe you were still alive?
To start out, she didn't believe it. Then I recorded my voice. I sent back to her. She not sure was my son.
I was going
to
say, the last time that you saw your mother, you were just a little boy.
Yeah.
And so here you are, all grown up. I don't know, maybe 35, 40 years old. You make a recording. How is your mother going to know it's you?
That's what I'm saying. She didn't know that. She didn't believe that anywhere.
And what about you? Did you believe it was your mother?
He went up there. He recalled it and bring back to me. Then I noticed my mother.
You recognized her voice.
I recognized the voice and I recognized my mother off my head. I said, I can't believe my mother's still alive.
Do you cry when you hear it?
I'm upset. I cry, but I'm not. I was thankful she's still alive. Very happy, kind of sad too, you know, all together. Then you plan to go back and you didn't have no money to go.
So you couldn't go?
I can't go back because I work in a factory, I'm on my own. I had to pay the trail payment, I got to pay my car, I don't have no money.
So it's like 5 or 6 years before you can get back to Cambodia yourself to see your mother.
Mm-hmm. When the airplane landing, my mom did not remember me, who I am anyway. My sister close to me remember me good. And I walk out from the airport, get out the door. There was a whole group, my family, that wait for me, you know. But my sister, the one know it.
She said, that's him. That's
Paul?
Yeah,
that's him. Yeah, that's brother, right? She come around to me, give me a hug, start crying, and my mom then come in all together.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It was Paul Somme's first trip back to Cambodia since he fled that land over 25 years earlier. I asked him if what he saw matched his memories of his country.
You went back in Cambodia, it's not the same country anymore. Just like new. From the rye field, no rye field. From the mountain, no mountain. They dig all the stone and just... I said, what happened?
Did you see anything that looked familiar?
I don't. The coconut tree, when I remember, was a short coconut tree, was like 40 or 50 feet tall. I don't remember that.
I know that when you went back to Cambodia, that you had your wife and your new baby here in America. I know you weren't going to leave them. But was there a part of you that thought, hey, this is Cambodia. This is my real home. Maybe I should come back here.
No, I still feel for Cambodia, but I don't feel like come back staying there because I have a family here in America.
If you could take your wife and your two boys, would you go to Cambodia?
My wife don't want to go. She has been through the same situation I do. She wouldn't want to go to visit Cambodia. Period.
She doesn't even want to visit.
She's not going to visit. She got fear from there. She still believed was the Khmer Rouge was still there, you know. I tell her everything's okay. She says she don't believe it.
And so do you think about yourself as Cambodian American or just plain American?
I'm a Cambodian American. I don't forget about where I come from.
So where's the real home?
Right now. He is an American now. That's the reason when I come here to an American, I do my best. I done everything my own. I'm not dependent on nobody because I think this is, I'm going to do better what I knew because I was hungry. I didn't have nothing. I want to have something.
And you have your own business?
That's right.
Why did you decide to open up a Thai boxing school?
I see a lot of martial art around the school was not very real, with fake.
Like karate,
flash stuff.
Judo,
yeah, that's it. Just
all
come
that's...
in, take people money. The martial art supposed to be the discipline, the responsibility. That's what I was there for, to help the kid. To teaching that children about the discipline, about the respect. I'm very traditional teaching.
Paul, all the stuff that you have been through, all the stuff with the Khmer Rouge, the refugee camp in Thailand, what did you learn from all that?
It's hard, you know. It just kind of say, well, I'm going to do better. That's all I think about every day, you know. I want to be better. That's what I'm tough. In my heart, that's what I'm in. I'm a tougher.
If all this stuff has just made you tougher and tougher, mm-hmm. Where's your soft spot?
I don't have one. I'm never quit it until I die. I don't stop.
Paul Paul Soom now owns a kickboxing studio in Asheboro, North Carolina. You can find a link to that on our website. The music we're listening to is Prahn's theme. It's from the film The Killing Fields. The courageous journalist Dith Prahn died this past weekend. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Last month, I talked with an engineer in Vermont who, 30 years ago, built an electric car in his own garage. Wayne Goldman nearly hit the big time. At one point, he had deals in the works with the Postal Service, with Avis Rental Cars, and he had backing from Exxon. Wayne told me that he drove this car to work and he loved it.
The strangest thing about driving an electric car is when you come to a red light, because you don't hear anything. And then you start to say, does the car still work? So you tap the accelerator slightly, and then you hear the clicking sound of the solenoid cutting in, and then you just hear this whirring sound. Driving on the highway, it was just fascinating.
Like being in a glider on a plane, where all you're hearing
yes,
is the sound of the
yes,
wind going past.
And you don't hear any noises. So what happens? You start hearing noises you hadn't heard before. You'd hear the disc brakes, you know, starting to touch, that type of thing.
And what about people who were standing beside the car when you'd come up to a stop sign or driving away?
Well, one of the problems is you couldn't get people to move. If you were in traffic, you didn't want to blow the horn, so you're going, excuse me. Nudging them out of the way.
All you needed was a big rubber bumper, and you could just gently push them out of
yeah,
the way.
Exactly.
One of our listeners, Terry Buell, heard Wayne Goldman on the radio and immediately thought of her father. You see, her father, Bill Buell, also worked on an electric car, and he did it when he was actually employed by General Motors. Like Wayne, Bill also became a little bit disappointed, disillusioned that the electric car never amounted to anything. But let me back up a bit. This story actually starts 35 years ago, back to Bill Buell's early days with GM. See, Bill had worked as a service engineer, but the job involved a lot of travel. Bill had a young family, so he decided to quit.
I was driving into work one morning, and I just said, that's it. I've had it, and I'm quitting. Because usually you came in Monday morning, you got assignment, and you were off. You flew to California or Canada or anywhere where the plant was.
Did you actually go in and say to your boss on that day, I'm done, this is my last day?
That's what I told him. Walt, I says, I quit. And he says, no, you can't. And I says, well, I can either walk out right now or I can give you 2 weeks' notice. And he says, let me have 2 weeks. So every day I would come back to my desk and there'd be an application there for an interview. And I'd tear it up, throw it in a wastebasket.
None of them interested you at all, right?
No, I never even looked at them, really. And the last day I was gone.
Before Bill could walk out the door, though, one of those pieces of paper his boss kept leaving on his desk did catch his eye. It was a call for applicants for people to work on a pet project of the man who was then GM's president, Ed Cole. The job was to assemble an electric car. Now, this was 1969, and there were some electric cars on the road at the time, but it was more like golf carts and things like that. Bill thought, before he actually left, he should look into this.
They took me in this lab, bigger than a house, had overhead cranes, and more tools than I'd seen in my life. And I was a real mechanic. I had a lot of tools. And they were stuck. They had spent all their money on the project, and they had no money left to build the thing. What they needed was a couple junior engineers and a couple technicians to do this project. And when I looked at it, I says, I can do that. You know, I've built cars all my life. What's to build an electric car? And, you know, electric was different. I never built an electric car. So it was so challenging, I just couldn't resist it. And So they said, what would it take to do this? So I just doubled the salary I was making at that time, and they took it.
No, wait a second. But you were going to be the technicians. You were going to be the construction crew. You were going to be the manager. You were the whole thing.
Yes. That's what sold me on it, is I had no bosses. Nobody to tell me what to do. It was my project and mine only.
But tell me something. Did you at the time really believe that you could build an electric car?
Sure. They did all the hard work. I mean, they had special DC traction motors. They had gearboxes built to mount the motors on. You know, all I had to do is fabricate it.
Well, you're making it sound like a Meccano said. It was a little more complicated than that.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, all I got was an electrical schematic and an electronic schematic and a million parts. They gave me a workbench, all the electronic controls I needed, soldering irons and, you know, the works. And I just sat there with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of electronic parts and assembled the whole thing.
Well, what do you think was really in the mind of the GM management at the time? I mean, 1969, we weren't necessarily in an oil crisis at that time. The price of gas wasn't through the roof. What kind of direction were you getting? Were you being told, give us an electric car and we'll see if we can, you know, mass market it?
Back then, every president in the company had pet projects. You know, one night I'm laying underneath the car on a creeper and somebody kicks my foot and I'm staring up at Dottie and Ed Cole.
That's the head of GM.
Yeah, he and his wife come down 10 o'clock at night to see how I was going along with the car.
I guess I'm wondering if this was a different GM. When you talk about this, oh, let's experiment with this and let's try that, it doesn't really much sound like the panicked car companies of these years when it's, oh my gosh, we got to get a market for this vehicle or we got to rush this into production.
Yes, it was a different GM. Back then, the people meant the most to General Motors when I first started, and I could see it through the years, and then slowly it changed to the bottom line. The stockbrokers is, you know, who you had to satisfy, and that's where the big panic comes in, because they're all afraid of making a mistake and getting voted off the board or losing their nice pension.
Yeah.
So the decisions are much harder nowadays than back then.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bill Buell spent a year working on that car for GM. And then finally, it was ready. Bill says it was a fine sight to behold.
It looked sleek. It was a Opel Kadett body, which was a very attractive, sporty-looking body.
This a hatchback or a sedan?
No, it was a sedan, a two-door. You know, it came with the fancy wheels, and it was picked out for me. It was there waiting for me. They picked something out that looked attractive, so when you finished a vehicle, you know, it wouldn't look like an ugly electric car.
Bill, what was the color of the XEP that you built?
I wanted to have it painted hugger orange, you know, like lightning.
What's a hugger orange? I don't know the...
That was a real orange paint that was on some of the Chrysler vehicles. Maybe that's why they wouldn't let me do it. It was a real bright orange. And so they said, pick something else. So I thought, well, how about electric blue? So it was a medium, very metallic blue. It sat four people. It probably weighed somewhere in the vicinity of 2,500 pounds, and I added 1,600 pounds to it. So it was a pretty heavy vehicle.
If I opened the hood on this car, what would I see? The batteries or the electric engine? What would I have seen?
All the electronics was under the hood. But what I did is I made a drawer out of the front bumper. You'd pull two pins, front bumper would pull out, and there was a big drawer with eight lead-acid batteries in it. Then the other batteries took up the whole trunk. They stacked on top of each other, so you didn't have a trunk whatsoever.
You had a lot of batteries.
Yeah, so it was fine for carrying people, but it wouldn't be practical to use if you wanted to haul stuff around. But again, this was what they call a test bed.
What was it like to drive?
It was like a normal car. It felt heavy, and it was.
Did it accelerate like a golf cart? You put the pedal to the floor, and it started to go...
No. Give you an example. I had just finished the last of the wiring, and my assistant department head, Neil Treiner, he was just raring to go. He wanted to go out for a ride in this. In fact, he wanted to take it for a ride. And he jumped behind the wheel, and I said, Neil, please, let me take it the first time. I said, I don't know what's going to happen. This hasn't been driven before. Yep. But I had put in a big breaker, which they didn't put in the drawing. And when I mentioned it to them, they didn't want it for some reason. But I put it in anyways.
And the breaker would do what, Bill? It would just cut the power?
Yeah, disconnected the batteries from the whole control system.
Okay.
Well, he went around, climbed in the other side. I started to climb in the seat, and I better open the door first. I went and opened the big steel door. I come back in. I said, okay, Neil, here we go. I threw the switch, and it started burning rubber, and it peeled all the way out probably 100 yards before I got it stopped. You know, I pulled the breaker, but there was so much momentum. We were sitting right in front of a hedge. I think the next step would have been in a field.
You're talking about a car, an electric car, which has more sort of get up and go than most gas-powered cars of its time.
Well, it's because you can dump horrendous amounts of current into those electric motors. I wouldn't run very long or very far, you know, pulling that kind of current out of it.
So what noise did it make when it was burning rubber? Because it's an electric engine.
Well, the engine itself, you need a big inductor in there to smoothen out the electric current, you know, that flows to the batteries through, you know, all the different SCRs and everything. So I was supposed to, according to the drawing, encapsulate the inductor into epoxy so it would be quiet, because inductors vibrate. The current flows through them and they just hum. And I thought, well, I want to know what this thing sounds like. I want to be able to hear it. I want people to hear it when it comes. So I wound it real loose and I mounted it in the trunk. And when you hit the accelerator, all you could hear is, and it just got louder the harder you hit it. And it was really nice. You know, everybody was impressed with it. They thought, boy, that was the greatest idea you ever had.
So you leave this trail of rubber all the way out of your plant up to the hedge. You finally get it stopped by throwing the breaker. Who's the first to speak, you or Neil?
Well, Neil couldn't talk for a little while. He had the biggest smile on his face that you could ever see. And when he finally did talk, he says, wow, can we do that again? Well, he thought I was showing off. He didn't know that he almost lost his life.
And there must have been a part of you, Bill, that wanted to get out of that car, run right up to the head office, grab the president of GM, Ed Cole, and say, get down here, check this out.
They wanted the whole world to see this thing, the president, you know, every newspaper to write about it. They wanted it to go down in history as being one of the most viable things they've ever built. And so they invited everybody, congressmen. I didn't see the president, but I wouldn't have been surprised if he had been there also. What they did is they wanted everybody to drive it. So I must have went around the tech center site, you know, 500 times that day.
How fast would you go?
I would never, on the site, wouldn't take it over 35, 40, you know, because every road was like a quarter mile, and then you turn another quarter mile and you turn. I did take a few people out on the test track, though, and kind of opened it up around 70 or so. But I had to watch it because they wanted everybody to get a ride, and I didn't want to kill the batteries you know, before everybody got their ride.
What was the thing like at 70 miles an hour?
Very stable. I mean, you know, if you take a go-kart and you fill it full of lead, it gets pretty stable.
So did you get your picture in the paper that day?
My picture went all over the world. Every newspaper. I had a pile of newspapers. I wish I would have kept them from Hawaii. Just anywhere you could think of where somebody printed a newspaper. And then they put me in the World Book of Knowledge, and I never got a copy.
Somebody out there listening to us now has a copy of that. We'll make sure that we get it to you.
Take a look.
And so there he was in 1970. GM was debuting its electric car, and the man who built it, Bill Buell, was on top of the world. His next assignment was to spend a year testing that car while GM's designers wrote up their reports. But once that process began, Bill started to get the hint that GM's enthusiasm for the electric car was waning.
Towards the end of the year, it came down that the people, the general public, weren't interested in something like this. People don't want a car that they're not going to be able to change their mind and decide to go another 100 miles. It's fine if you got a vehicle to drive back and forth to work, but decide you want to go see your friend on the other side of the state. You can't take that vehicle. So GM said, we're not going to work on this anymore. We're just going to work on batteries. So the whole vehicle project died, and they told us that we had our offices for 3 months, that the project was done, and we should go look for another job. So a director called me, and he says, Bill, he says, geez, I meant to call you months ago. I want you to work for our electrochemistry department. I want you to help design new batteries. And, well, you know, I thought it over, and I ended up going to work for the electrochemistry department, and I really don't know whatever happened to the other five people.
You must have been disappointed.
Well, you know, I knew that the electric vehicle, pure electric, wasn't practical. You know, you learn that when you build them and see what the limitations are. But I did think that GM kind of screwed up not following up the hybrid, because they could have been 38 years ahead of themselves.
Do you know what happened to that test model, that XEP, the Opel Kadett?
Yes. It sat in our research lobby for probably 20 years at least. And then one day I was asked to start it up. And that's like burying something for 20 years and digging it out of the ground and starting it up.
No kidding.
And I says, there's no way this is ever going to run. The electronic control system is 20 years old. I says, it'll never run, not after sitting and neglected for 20-some years. So they took it out and crushed it. I was sad about that. I thought at least they could have done is put it in one of their museums. But they told me that it was sent to the shredder. So I'm not sure. It could be out there. For all I know, is every once in a while a GM vehicle that was supposed to be crushed shows up. So you never know.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Decades later, when gas prices started rising again, GM revived its efforts to build an electric car. I asked Bill Buell if he considered getting involved once again, giving it another try.
At the time they were starting this project, they sent out these like employment feelers to everybody electronically, and it was like 20 pages long, and they wanted to know everything about you, what you think about, what you do at home, what you've done at work, you know, what you're interested in, what would you like to do. And all I could see is I knew the electric project was coming up, and I didn't want to be involved in another one. I figured one died, that's enough. I don't want to work on something for the next 10 years and then, you know, see it go down the drain. So I put the name of my department and as my job, I put expediter, and never heard a word from them. So I was happy.
You intentionally wrote yourself out of competition for that job.
Right. You know, I had a job as an operations manager. I was helping run our department, and I liked what I was doing.
Why did you turn down the chance, though, to be a part of the next electrical vehicle project? You clearly had fun with the first one.
Yeah, but different times. You know, back then, you know, I had the sole word on the vehicle. I could do anything I wanted. If I would have went with them on this, that would have been just a tiny little piece, a tiny little clog in the wheel, let's say. Probably wouldn't have much input. I'd be looking, wondering more than building and doing.
Did you ever think about building yourself an electric vehicle at home?
I'd thought about it, but again, the practicability of it, what would I use it for?
If your car, if that XEP had been pursued, maybe switched into a hybrid, maybe something else, who knows? But if the company had stayed behind it 38 years ago, where do you suppose we might be now?
That's a good question. I would say they would be on top of the world right now.
Do you ever allow yourself a moment of regret, a sort of missed moment?
No, not at all. To me, after building that, I didn't have to do another thing the rest of my life. I really achieved something different, something neat. You know, how many people in life get a chance to do something like that? So I just figured I was real fortunate, and so the project died. So what? I built something that I really enjoyed.
Bill Buell lives in Roseville, Michigan. You can see pictures of that electric blue car, the XEP, on our website at story.org. And a reminder that The Story came to us from Bill's daughter, Terry Buell. If you have a hand or have had a hand in finding creative, perhaps even historic ways to lighten the weight of our footprint here, or maybe you know someone who's done that, or you're related to someone who's done that, I'd like to hear from you. The fastest way to get in touch with me is through our website at thestory.org. You can send me a short message or just pick up the phone and give me a call at 1-888-966-9862. I'll say that again, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Thank you.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.